world. So she ended up on a Davide Mount team and wrote one of the most cited papers on inflation. But it's great to have her here, I guess, for the first time. So she's going to tell us about fingerprints of the early universe. I guess it means inflation, right?
Yeah. Okay. Thanks very much, Yanesh, for inviting me here. I've wanted for ages to come here and get the muck. sorry about the edge being clipped off. I'll try to say if there's something important. But basically, I'm going to talk about what we can learn about the early universe data. And we all know what is inflation. The basic problem with the inflation paradigm is that it's usually modeled as, say, a scalar field evolving the potential, and many different potentials from different motivations are consistent with the data. So if what you really want to understand is something about the physics, then you're in a bit of trouble. For example, I like this quotation from David Schramm. Inflation consists of taking a few numbers we don't understand and replacing it with a function we don't understand. These are very valid questions. Where did this function, VFI, come from? What set the initial conditions for the photon? Why is the shape of the potential so flat in order to satisfy all the cosmological constraints? And how do we reheat the universe? So all of these encapsulate physics which are not captured by the standard field theory kind of slow roll models. So how can we learn about this physics? So in order to get some handle on this physics from the data, there are various approaches that are taken in the literature. The most common is to make empirical parametrizations of the primordial power spectrum that's predicted by inflation. For example, here for the spectral index, it's taken to be a function that's measured at some value of physical scale k naught plus some scale dependence parameters like that. So basically what this is trying to say is that, okay, the theory itself predicts some weakly scale-dependent function, and we are going to do the thing that astronomers usually do and put a power law on it and measure these parameters. This kind of approach is adequate for current data. It's an unnecessary approximation for future data, but it's still useful for understanding generic predictions that are made by various classes of simple models. Another approach that one might take is bottom-up direct reconstruction of the inflaton potential. And this kind of program was first discussed in the 90s, and it's just becoming feasible to do it. It's complicated by the fact that, for example, the CMB data only probes a very small part of the evolution of the inflaton. That's expected to be about 60 e-folds to explain all the cosmological constraints we have. So it becomes a bit of an extrapolation, or a lot of an extrapolation, as I talk about. So can we get some handle on the whole of the potential just by sampling this little piece? The final one is a top-down approach. It's model testing. So you take some physical model which comes from, say, a higher dimensional theory like string theory, and hopefully you find some distinct observables that this thing predicts that differentiates it from a generic prediction like that one. And then you have to test many, many, many of these models and then use some kind of model comparison statistic to see which one is right. So this is a sampling of the various kind of approaches that you might think about in terms of interpreting something about physics from this data. So I'm going to give little snapshots of each of these and then finally talk about what a future experiment might be able to do. So the first one I talk about is this bottom-up reconstruction. It's an old problem, first talked about in the 90s. Can we observe the primordial perturbations and reconstruct the potential? So this is the kind of idea we have. So there's the potential, there's a simple Storer potential as a function of field or scale. So large scales, like the horizon, it's over here. That's small scales. There's roughly about 60 e-folds of evolution between these. And the CMB, of course, is at the largest scales. That's large-scale structure. Here, possible constraints from 21 centimeter observations. And these are all roughly of the order of horizon scale. And then roughly at solar system scales, maybe in the future, we'll have something, direct gravitational detection experiments. But even combining all of these, we can probably only hope to get the amplitude of the potential and the first two or three derivatives. So obviously you can see the problem here, right? If the potential cannot be described by just a few low order derivatives like this, then this whole program is in trouble. So with that caveat, let's go on. Okay, so density perturbation, of course, is one of the primary observables we have from inflation. So the primordial scalar power spectrum are usually parameterized by an amplitude and a spectral index like that. And there are many, many models that are described by just these two parameters, many simple field theory models. There is a question whether this spectral index is a function of scale and whether that deviation is observable. So these perturbations are, of course, a function of the potential. Okay? So cosmological scales range from about a megaparsec to about 10 to the 4 megaparsec. So that's about 4 orders of magnitude. But the universe grows by a factor of about 10 to the 30 times larger during inflation. So if we infer something from cosmological scales, then describe from cosmological scales till the end of inflation, you have to make a big extrapolation both in scales and energy scales and in physics. So CMB only samples a small piece of the potential. The approach that I have been using to implement this kind of reconstruction is the Hamilton-Jacobi approach, in which you say that the potential, the field is a function of a monotonic function of time. So you can take time out of the evolution equations. This is the second FRW equation for the evolution of the imputon. This is the first. I'm sorry about this. This is H prime over here. And then you can write the first Laurel parameter, which is the slope parameter, as this. This is just a definition. And you can replace this H prime in here by this epsilon. So this is just rewriting this equation here. So you can see that if you can measure H of phi and epsilon of phi as a function of phi, then you get the potential. So that's a basic idea about the reconstruction.
So this assumes that phi involves monotonic?
Phi is a monotonic function of time in this simple form. You can account for multiple fields in this approach as well.
If it turns around,
or if it has features, then usually this kind of reconstruction algorithm fails. And for those models, you actually have to consider distinctly what's going to happen. For example, if there's a little feature in the potential, something like that, it typically cannot be described by slow linear noise parameters. In the next thing I'm going to talk about, I'll show you an example. So, of course, there's an infinite hierarchy of these kind of small derivatives you can write down. There's the slope, the curvature eta, the jerk. So these encapsulate the first three derivatives of the potential, essentially. The next three apparently are called snap, crackle, and pop. You will probably never be able to get any handle on these in the future, even. So I'll concentrate on these three. So if you write down an infinite hierarchy of these parameters, it captures the inflationary dynamics exactly.
Are these definitions in terms of H prime and H are they the same as derivatives with respect to number of equals of the equations?
You can write that. You can turn this phi into k, you can turn this phi into time, you can turn it into number of equals. That's right.
But this is phi here.
This is phi here.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just wondering if the reason I'm asking it, I'm wondering if for example, you could have a model where the equation of state doesn't change very fast in time,
mm-hmm.
but you would nevertheless need a lot of these to go to very high order.
That's right.
Or does that never happen?
It does happen, but again, the reconstruction paradigm failed there. You need a lot of parameters to reconstruct it. You really need to start from the original model and make a prediction and do a top-down thing. I'll talk about it next, I promise. Actually, when I do this algorithm numerically, I use default because it's much more stable numerically. So in terms of this infinite hierarchy, it captures the full dynamics, but typically we have to truncate it because there's just no handle on more than roughly 3 parameters from the data. And that gives you an approximate potential, so a piece of a potential that you can fit the observable scales. But this truncated hierarchy has an exact solution. So it's just saying that up to some order, m plus 1, you're going to capture it with these slow roll parameters. But you're setting all the rest to 0. And this is a simple equation with this simple solution. It's a set of polynomials. And these coefficients of the polynomials are directly related to the slow roll parameters measured at some scale k. But once you measure them at some scale k, you get them at all other scales, because this is an exact formalism, OK? So this is the approach that we want to do. So here's the algorithm. So you pick these slow roll parameters as some fiducial wave number, which arbitrarily we set to be phi equals 0. Then you can calculate k as a function of phi. You use these analytic solutions to h, epsilon, and eta to calculate the primordial power spectra. You can do that direct integration as well, because that gives you a potential which you then can integrate numerically the evolution equations. Then you can feed these power spectra into, for example, a standard Boltzmann code like CHEM and calculate the CMB power spectra and compare the data. That's a basic idea. But like I said, you're measuring these small number of parameters and you're fitting them to a small part of the interson potential. So can you say something more about not just that part, but the whole potential? You can try to apply physical consistency priors. By that I mean, if this part of the potential is fit by this kind of model, and you extrapolate it into the future, you see if that gives you some weird observable which contradicts what's actually observed in the universe. Okay, so I'll discuss a few of these possible priors. One is a prior on the duration of inflation. So, this is very unfortunate because there's a lot of information there that's cut off.
Can you move it a little bit right?
Maybe. Yeah, I think the left part is more important than
I yeah. Can
you hear us?
What are you talking to?
Is there somebody fixing me?
Yeah, they are monitoring your.
Hello?
Could you move it so that the left hand side they could see it better?
Can you minimize this? I mean, go
out. I've tried several resolutions.
Exit the full screen mode.
Oh,
press
okay.
Escape. And, yeah.
Okay. Can you actually see that? Let me just see if I can increase the size. That's also annoying because there's a movie. Anyway, okay. Now it's gone to the wrong. Yes, please. Because I can't see the menu now to increase the size.
Oh, I see. You cannot see.
Yeah.
I didn't realize.
Anyway.
Okay, but.
Well, it's plus. It's the common Apple plus, perhaps.
You can go all the way like that. It's not mirroring the display. Oh, this is 51%. Maybe you make it larger.
Yeah, that's what I'm.
Try 75. Okay. Perhaps. That should be good enough. Okay. So. Oh, I'm very sad about my movie. Anyway, what's shown here is that the scale factor on this axis versus the physical length scale on that axis. So the issue here, if you could have seen it, is that just having this blue part here, that's the universe without having inflation, of course. So there's matter domination, radiation domination. Everything that's colored here is causally connected. This is the scale of the current horizon. And you can see that without inflation, basically it's not connected in the past, and so you have the horizon problem and all those things. Inflation solves it by having roughly a constant co-moving Hubble radius during inflation, so it comes back into causal contact with the rest of the universe. So that's a current horizon. Here's, for example, a galaxy scale, roughly a galaxy scale which is much smaller, so it leaves the horizon later after the current horizon, and then comes back first during the radiation dominated era, whereas this is what's just coming into the universe. So you can actually see that this is a function of E fold, function of phi, and if you measure a particular amplitude for the power spectrum at this particular k, it corresponds to a particular E fold, right? That's kind of obvious. But then you have to know where that is before the end of inflation, if you're comparing it with a theoretical model. So for example, so the constraint that we have is that the co-moving Hubble radius at the onset of inflation is greater than the co-moving Hubble radius today to solve the horizon problem here. So if you have roughly 50 to 60 defaults here, that's going to solve the horizon problem. So now let's take a particular pivot scale k here. So that leaves during inflation at some point and re-enters at some other point. But now imagine that reheating didn't happen instantaneously. And there was, for example, a matter-dominated epoch between the end of inflation and reheating. So now this scale has left the horizon at some other time and it's sampling another part of the potential than what we assumed when we were saying that reheating was instantaneous. So in comparing a theoretical model to an observation, that's not going to give you the right answer. So somehow you have to account for this uncertainty. And this is not trivial. For example, if you say that rough constraints on reheating temperature is that either it was instantaneous, that's roughly the gut scale, 10 to the 15 GeV. The lowest it can really be is the nuclear synthesis scale, about an MeV. So between these, there's several orders of magnitude. And they translate into a delta NE fold of about 14. And the resulting uncertainty in predicting where you were before the end of inflation, and therefore the observational constraint, is in the tensor scalar ratio, delta R over R is roughly 1. And the uncertainty in the spectral index is of the order of 0.02.
If I had reheated a nuclear synthesis, mm-hmm. that's a very small number of e-folds, like 20.
Right.
So
it's basically the number of e-folds between what the smallest it can be and the largest.
But that would be more like 14. Like between 16, which is gut scale, and nuclear synthesis, which is 20, the uncertainty is 14. I think, isn't it true that your 14 comes from, you're saying that you're already around, but I thought it was that if you assume that the reheating is the slowest possible and it's amplifying suppressed,
that's
then
right.
You get 50. But if it's just an argument about reheating temperature, then I think the delta N is much larger.
Well, if it's much larger, then this becomes even worse.
Right.
This is kind of a conservative number.
Right.
Okay. So this is, I think this is about 14, but maybe I'm wrong. This is not the order of magnitude, it's the number of people.
What is
Well, I think if you reheat to TeV temperature, mm-hmm. like when you do TeV mm-hmm. inflation, mm-hmm. the size of our co-moving Hubble mm-hmm. to the Hubble at TeV reheating mm-hmm. is 26.
Yeah, so that's a statement about the number of defaults between the Hubble horizon and today,
right.
the end
right.
of inflation. Because this is a statement about the uncertainty in the reheat scale. So
that's what I mean.
Yeah.
So if it's TeV, it's 26.
Mm-hmm.
If it's
mm-hmm.
gut scale, it's 60.
Mm-hmm.
So the uncertainty in reheating temperature
okay.
translates
so
into...
So the 20 number is the one I'm not quite sure about. But,
it's okay.
The larger this is, the worse this problem becomes.
Yeah.
Is what I'm trying
this
to say.
One is just assuming, is it just the ratio of the energies, right? That
yeah, that's right.
But if you assume some variation in k,
Maybe that's where the discrepancy is coming from. This is just these two temperatures.
Yes.
Okay, so hopefully now I can go back to my talk. Right, so I just want to make the point that given this uncertainty, that translates into unacceptable uncertainty in terms of making an experimental prediction. Really is me off. Okay. So this means that you somehow have to account for this repeating uncertainty in your reconstruction algorithm. So the connection equation in a universe that inflated, reheated, and then passed through matter radiation equality is written as follows. So this is the number of defaults corresponding to some physical scale k. And this actually is exact if you assume that these transitions happened instantaneously and that the standard number of degrees of freedom were there. So it has the reheat scale, the scale at the end of inflation, and the energy scale of this physical scale when it passed out of the horizon. And so this is the number that we don't know. So given the theory, we know this. And unless we have an actual physical model for reheating, we don't know that. And in this reconstruction thing, the whole point is not to assume a model. So we can put some priors on this parameter. So some minimal prior is, for example, as follows. You say that all the required inflation is 15 epochs. Just give us the 15 epochs that we see in cosmological scale. So that's very minimal prior. Another one you might say is that T reheating is greater than 10 MeV, and that actually guarantees a thermalized neutrino sector. And the moment you run CAM, you assume that, because CAM assumes that. So maybe this is the one we should really use in cosmological analysis as a minimal prior. You can say that it happens well above the 10 TeV, and that means reheating occurs well above the electroweak scale. Or you can assume the strongest prior, that repeating happens right at the end of inflation.
No, sorry, apparently he says he cannot do anything.
You can just move it to the right.
No, apparently it's cut from the laptop. That's what he says. If he moves it, it doesn't.
Okay,
stop. Yeah.
Anyway, so this was supposed to say that this is the weaker and this becomes stronger on this axis. So when you have just two slow roll parameters, so here's one epsilon and here's eta, and I've just taken phi equals 0 to correspond to k equals 0.02 inverse megaparsecs, because that's the tightest constraint scale by current cosmological data. These are what these priors look like. So the priors are on this parameter, remember. This is our minimal prior. Everything above that is allowed by the prior. This is the 10 TeV prior. And this is the instant reheating prior. So anything that's white or is above its curve is allowed by the prior. So then you carry out this reconstruction algorithm using just the first two slow roll parameters. And you can see that basically this minimal prior doesn't affect the constraints. And this curvature you're seeing for the instant reheating prior is just saying that part of the parameter space is not compatible with the assumption of instant preheating. Okay? And then you can, of course, just take this space and translate it into the usual parameters people know about, which is the spectral index and the tensor scale ratio. And you get these funny contours where there's a gap here. But that's just the form of the prior that's been translated into this gap. And so the blue contours are from WMAP, the latest release. And red contours are from the WMAP release plus the supernova legacy survey. And you can see some usual suspects of actual potentials here. Here's lambda phi to the fourth, which is firmly ruled out. There's n squared phi squared, which is allowed. So this is a function of epochs. And 60 epochs or 50 is within the contours. Here's a representative natural inflation model. So you can see some of the usual suspects are still within the contours. Some are starting to be ruled out. So that's with two parameters. So now let's add one more and see what we can say about that.
So it's better, it's far better the instant tree.
So this is the really prior here, okay? Greater than 10 to EV. The difference between this and the instant one is not much. So you can see them here. But there's a big difference between this and this minimal prior. So this is the three-parameter case where now we have epsilon, eta, and xi. And xi is what controls really the running of the spectral index. When you add this prior, the main effect is to eliminate models with large positive xi. So here's the minimal prior. This is xi versus eta. And I think you can see the difference much better in this one. Anyway, so let's ignore that. This is the instant reheating prior, the strongest one, and this is the weakest one, n is greater than 15. And the main difference between these two is that this large positive psi region has been ruled out by the prior. And that's because in those models, large positive psi means large negative running, and inflation ends very soon after the cosmological scales leave the horizon. So it's a form of physical consistency in which you say, I want not just the observable power spectrum generated by inflation, but I want sufficient default to solve the horizon problem. So when you translate that to these parameters,
can I ask you something? Mm-hmm. So the Hn, is that where epsilon becomes 1 or something? Is that how you get it?
In this... that's a very good question. In the previous case where we just had two, all models end by the breakdown is not all.
So that's the definition of the
prior. Yeah, but in this case, not, right? For xi greater than zero, mm-hmm. It does end by breakdown is not all. But these models here actually inflate forever.
Okay.
With large negative xi. And so you have to assume a hybrid transition to end the inflation in those models. I was going to come to that next. Very good question. Okay. So when you then translate this into the space that people have an intuition about, so here's the spectral index that it's running, measured at this tightly constrained scale. For comparison, I've showed what happens when you do a standard analysis, just using these two parameters in your analysis. And all of this space that's allowed by just naively fitting this to the data doesn't support enough defaults to inflation. This was supposed to be N versus R, the tensor scalar ratio. So that's the standard analysis. And this is when you have this physical consistency bias. And all of this parameter space is inconsistent with the assumption that you can solve the horizon problem. With regard to Yanish's question, you have this part which is left. And in those, inflation doesn't end. So you can do a couple of things. You can say, can we use something about, let's say inflation ends in the maximal necessary number of defaults. And can we say something about the physical conditions at the end of inflation and put a prior on this parameter space? And one thing that we thought of doing was primordial black hole overproduction. So these are models where during the cosmological scales leaving the horizon, the power spectrum goes from being red to blue. And then it carries on being blue, and from 10 to the minus 9 at cosmological scales, at the end of inflation, it has grown to something quite dramatic. So let's put a mild prior on the amplitude of the power spectrum at the end of inflation. And this constraint actually has not been worked out rigorously. So what we did in this particular analysis is to assume two different forms of it, one of which was, the primordial scale of power spectrum is less than 10 to the minus 2 at the end of inflation, and that cut out this little bit up here. And then you say it's less than 10 to the minus 3 at the end of inflation, and that cut out this here. So you're actually working on deriving this limit rigorously right now, but this was rough rule of thumb kind of thing, what it does. It rules out that space. There's also a slightly weaker prior which you can put on. at the end of inflation. In these models, the blue tilt becomes so large at the end of inflation that PFR gets greater than 1. So that's one of the, so you can kind of see that eternal inflation will start in the observable universe. And we know that's not happening, so that's also a physical consistency check. And we see here that if you just have WMAP data plus this no eternal inflation prior, you get the black constraints. And actually, the current data combined with supernova data is almost strong enough that you don't need this prior. They're giving roughly the same kind of constraints.
So what does this mean? PRR is less than 10 to the minus 10 from WMAP. So
That's a cosmological scale.
Okay, so
now you're extrapolating that to the end of inflation.
Okay, so you say at the end of inflation, PRR is less than 1.
For this prime.
For this prime.
Yeah.
And the previous one is 10 to the minus 2 and 10 to the minus 3.
Yeah.
You mean at the size of the reaching horizon?
Yeah.
Okay, and the fluctuations or zeta at the end of the ring.
Okay. Yes.
So, intuitively, what happens? So why does inflation end naturally? Because the potential just
it's gets unbounded.
Flatter and flatter.
It's a, yeah. So it goes to basically a flat region. Yeah. So there's inflection point in the potential during the cosmological scales. So the power spectrum goes from red to blue.
Right.
And then. Yeah.
So this is zeta, right? The rules.
This is
psi.
Yeah, the third one. Yeah. So that's the same constraint in the other cells. So anyway. So just to summarize that part of the talk, just the two Sloral parameters, the constraints are roughly the same as just fitting these empirical parameters. With these three Sloral parameters, most of the parameter space that's allowed by fitting these empirical parameters is ruled out by physical priors, and for example, duration of inflation, primordial black hole overproduction, and avoiding the onset of eternal inflation during in the observable body. So these are, I should emphasize, physical priors. In order to constrain the data with constrain these models with data rather than with priors, you need a significant improvement in the quality of the data, for example, from Planck. And then what one would do, you can imagine, is to do one fit like this, and one fit implementing these physical priors, and then you see if there's an inconsistency between them, and that will signal that these three parameter fits are not a good description of the data. So let me just go on to a different approach, which is a top-down approach.
So, Brian,
yes.
So what you're saying is that we didn't need to do the WMAP at all. We just needed this slow-roll model with those priors.
That is true with the two parameters. Yeah. We didn't know where the we didn't know what the n sub s. That was told us by WMAP. Okay.
Right, so that was all we needed.
Yeah, so data currently constrains the spectral index. It does not really constrain the tensor scalar ratio. It does not really constrain the running of the spectral index. The top-down approach is as follows. So this is the opposite of the previous very generic program. So you have a bunch of 4D Lagrangians you can write down, and some fraction of those will be phase-shaped Lagrangians in the effective field theory picture. But then imagine you want to derive from for example, fundamental theory like a string compactification, a set of inflation Lagrangians. So the hope in this kind of program would be that these sets of Lagrangians will have distinct observable signatures that distinguish them from these field theory kind of toy model Lagrangians. And then we could go and look for those observables in the data. So as an example, let me present this case. It is called the infrared multi-throat DBI inflation. And so you have some kind of flux compactification like this. And anti-brain flux annihilation generates inflatons as, brains as candidate inflatons. They exit this throat, so they roll out of that throat, and they come into another throat, and that's where inflation ends in this kind of picture. So if you have enough warping to these throats, you get DBI inflation. If you have a flat potential, you get slower inflation. And this differs from the usual case people talk about with UV DVI inflation, which all takes place in a single throw with the brain going into the throat like that. So the differences between the UV and the IR models, in UV DVI, this anti-brain tension cannot drive inflation because it's warped down by the warp factor. So you need a steep potential to raise the inflation energy. So the potential in these cases is there's this mass term which is very dominant over just the naive Coulomb attraction between the brain and the antagonist. In the UV case, the speed limit from the DBI sound speed is independent of the anti-brain tension. So the speed limit comes from the B throat that it rolls out of, and the inflation energy comes from the A throat where it goes into. So there has to be this flexible shape of potential. And it has to be repulsive for brains, because otherwise this thing will not rule out. So at the time we did this work, there was a caveat here that an explicit construction for these repulsive potentials was not there. Just had to be put in by hand, this minus sign here. So basically this term had to be cancelled or over-cancelled in order to get that. But recently there's been a paper by Bauman et al. Here, where they say that these repulsive potentials are even generic. In brain inflation.
Why does it have to be repulsive? Why can't it just be a question of initial condition?
It could. I guess then you'd have to find the initial conditions. So this model has distinctive observables, like we hoped at the start of this program. So if you look at the B throat, which is the one that the brain rolls out of, at some level here, the field theory applies, but as you go deeper and deeper into the throat, you have to take into account springy effects. So if you consider the Hubble energy over the redshifted brain tension, it increases as you go into the throat. And at some level, you have open string creation, and at some other level, you have closed string creation, and eventually that will pinch off the throat. So in this part of this progression of the brain out of the throat, the spectral index is red. But because there's lots of power being created here by this open string creation, it's blue. So there's a transition of the spectrum from being blue to red. And that's a transient thing. It's not like I discussed before, that there's a scale dependence at all scales. It's a transient. There's also a large non-Gaussian signature, and it has the opposite running or scale dependence from this UV case we talked about before. It has an undetectable gravitational wave background. So there are three observables that you can relate and you can look at the consistency between from the data.
Negative,
sorry?
Is it negative?
It's negative, but it has an opposite scale from the case we did.
So can I ask?
Yeah.
So where does the inflation end?
Inflation ends in another throat. It has to come out and roll through the bulk and find an anti-brain in another throat.
During the time that it spends in the bulk?
Nothing much observation.
But it's still inflating?
Inflation mostly happens in the throat.
Okay.
That's a good question again, because as far as I know, the explicit metrics for these collabials are not known, so you can't do a controlled calculation in them.
So it could take a long time for the brain to find its way through your
I think I'm not the right person to answer that question. Yes?
There are many compactifications.
Mm-hmm.
So why are you choosing this particular
class? This is a flux compactification, that's a generic class that people have examined, the KKLMMT class.
There's a huge potential.
That's right. So this is this kind of model is very early on in trying to implement inflation in string theory. And there are several classes of models. So this is one of the main classes people consider, I think, because the calculations can be done to a certain level very well. There are other compactifications that people have implemented inflation in the last year. And there's these monodromy models and so on. And they have different signatures.
Okay.
This has these three observable signatures, and they're different from the other ones. If you're a theorist, you'd probably give a different answer, which is there's some theoretical preference for one class over the other. But as an observer, I'm going to say that if it makes a prediction and it doesn't satisfy the observables, then that's it. So I don't want to really go into the details of what this is, but basically you can constrain the primordial parameters of this model with data, and the only thing I really want to show you is that these likelihood surfaces are very non-Gaussian, and the best fit chi-square is about the same level as the Lagrangian model. And here are some constraints on the predicted power spectrum. Remember I said that this thing has a transient running. You can see the transient running over here. So this is scale, and this is the primordial power spectrum in dimensionless units. These are the scales covered by WMAP, STSS, Large Red Galaxy Survey, and Laminar Forest, which was actually not used for this analysis. If you just fit the three empirical observable spectral index and its running and an amplitude to the data, you get these constraints in dashes. And if you do that slow-roll reconstruction I talked about before, you get this set of constraints. What I really want to show here is that the current data is not good enough to distinguish between that form, and that form. You need better data. They roughly have the same chi square. So you need an improvement in the data for this.
But can you have more parameters for this?
I do.
And the fact that they give you the same chi square, that's not very good.
No, that's I disagree. This is an explicit model. We are not just fitting some power loss to the data. So
but you say it has more parameters than lambda CDM model?
It has more parameters than lambda CDM model, but it's an explicit model that makes a whole bunch of distinct observable predictions and makes them in a more rigorous way than just writing down power law and fitting that to the data. What I'm trying to say is that eventually you will be able to distinguish between these three things. And chi-square is not necessarily the way to evaluate how good that is. But currently it has roughly the same chi-square, so you can't really say anything. In terms of non-Gaussianity, here's scale again. And that's the production form of the non-Gaussianity parameter. These are WMAP scales. And these are the current constraints. And basically most of the constraints are coming from roughly these scales. And this is the WMAP limit. So Planck will detect anything above about here. So this model will be falsified or detected by Planck. And there's a scale dependence on non-Gaussianity. So eventually, this is very early days with this kind of thing yet. But eventually, the program will be to make models that predict distinctly observable signatures and do it in a way that the underlying fundamental physics can be explicitly and self-consistently calculated. Then you look for these observables, and if you find something, then you can maybe say something about the fundamental theory. But it's, like I said, very early days for that. How much time do I have?
15 minutes,
okay.
I'd just like to say again that string theorists have shown that because of the landscape problem, there are claims that you cannot use observations to constrain string theory at present.
Are they particularly talking about the cosmological constant problem there?
Well, whatever. Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily think that's going to be a problem for this approach, because just because you can write down a million different effective field theories doesn't mean that we can't say anything about effective field theory. And eventually what these things boil down to is a 4D effective theory.
And it's actually been fairly hard to get inflation.
Exactly. It's very
so
hard.
So I think this is, of all the hard things in string theory, this is one of the easier hard things.
And it's only been really happening in the last 3 or 4 years. and there's some very interesting stuff coming out. For example, this particular compactification leads to a DBI action, which if you just wrote it down as reflective field theory, this weird looking action, where would that come from? But it comes from this particular motion of this brain in this particular background, and then you have an underlying explanation for why is the action of that form. And on top of that, it made these predictions for observables that are not there in standard slow roll inflation.
But I repeat, there's probably a semi-infinite number of compactifications, obviously. So how can you...
But those are the collabiales, right?
No, but there's an infinite number of collabiales. No one's ever proved that there's a finite number.
The conjecture is that there are only finite number of collabiales. The conjecture is that there are only a finite number of collabiales.
That's never been proved.
Or as well.
Anyway.
Even if there are an infinite number of collabiales, I think that doesn't necessarily mean that you can get inflation out of them. Because it's proved to be a very hard thing so far.
But the point is, if you find a good model that comes out of that uses the tools of string theory, then you're happy. I mean,
yeah.
If we found there's a million different ways you can write down algebras, and we found out that the SU string process, U process, U1 model describes our world, and we're happy.
Yeah.
Not because we think that that proves that gauge groups are the truth. It's just we found the right one.
Yeah. That's what I was trying to say.
You can use these tools and find the model, and it matches the data. And you have some of those, these are the right kind of tools to be using. Mm-hmm. They don't have to make any grand statements.
Mm-hmm.
Just because some string theorists like making grand statements doesn't mean you have to impose those grand statements on everybody.
But I guess the question is it any different than just writing an arbitrary potential?
If you do something which is controlled, then you know that you're making sense, depending on some UV thing.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of these low energy effective field theories,
you don't
expect to make any sense.
You don't know the ultraviolet completion of those forces from this point.
Okay. I have a specific question.
Yes.
So FNL, equilateral,
yes,
being negative, so is there a existing string construction where FNL turns out to be positive?
As far as I know, there isn't.
There isn't?
In the curvature scenario, it can be slightly positive.
Or helix or field, that's right. But on the equilateral side, so all of these models that give positive FNL equilateral, they all somehow violate these nice DPI forms.
I think so.
That's not level. That's not.
Yeah. The only limited statement I want to make is I don't know any that type of support.
Does Caverton give you equilateral?
Does
Caverton model give you equilateral local contribution as well?
No, it's local.
Local.
So it can squeeze.
Chaos seems to give you equilateral with helix.
So I'm going to skip this part, which I was really hoping that Neil would be here, but he's not. So I won't cause controversy with that. Instead, tell you.
We can convey the message.
Okay. I'll tell you something about what a whole group of people have been trying to do recently to try to understand what a CMB polarization mission can do. And you might have noticed a whole flood of papers in the archive last week when everybody was off for Thanksgiving, so maybe nobody read them. But there's a whole set of CMB poll mission capability studies. And the main goal of the CMB poll type mission is to measure the tensor scalar ratio if it's within a measurable state. So the current constraints on the tensor scalar ratio is roughly the amount of data that R is less than about 0.2. So that's enough to rule out lambda phi to the fourth effective potential, but leaves a whole bunch of other predictions untested. Very optimistically, you can perhaps hope to observe something greater than about 0.001. And of course, theoretically, this can be much, much, much less than that. So that's the problem. We don't know whether the actual universe lies in this range or not. And this limitation here comes mainly from being unable to subtract galactic foregrounds accurately. And I think I probably don't need to tell anyone in this room that measurement of tensors gives you two pieces of information. One is that it fixes the energy scale of inflation, and another is that it says something very definite about the field variation during inflation in Planck units has to be greater than Planck mass. This is where we are currently with CMB polarization data. Since that's been cut off, that's the TE and the EE that has been started to be measured now, and that's already told us some interesting things. But to say something about tensor modes, we have to measure the EB power spectrum. And here's the WMAP 5-year constraint. Here's the best one here at large scales. Here's a whole bunch of upper limits from small-scale CMB experiments. And you can see that we are still, this is a logarithmic scale, we are still well above what is needed even for the very highest possible signatures for the tensor scalar ratio. So this is R of 0.2. This is R of 0.01, and this is 0.001. I think those are projected constraints from some experiment, not including foreground, so I'll not talk
about it. Can you write something simple? So the bound from WMAP is actually not coming from not measuring V modes, but it's coming from EP, right?
Yes, that's right. Yes. Okay. So you can see that this is the bound that I said in the previous thought, that is the current bound, but that's coming from the TP, not by this limit. This limit is very, very weak if you just fit the TP by itself. The problem with this contribution is that even at the highest expected levels, the B-mode contribution is very small. So this is roughly the current observed limit, and this is no tensors. And if anybody in the room can actually spot the difference between them, big prize for you. So the relative amplitudes of CMB power spectra are given here. So this is scale, and that's the amplitude, so it's the power square rooted. That's that R 0.3, roughly from the previous left-hand side plot. This is what we think we can do with the CMB core mission that was talked about in the papers last week. So WMAP noise levels are like that. That's the EMO that's just being measured and starting to be measured accurately. Planck can get down to there. And this is just noise. This is no foregrounds, nothing. This is a so-called low-cost CMB pole strawman mission, and that basically has very good sensitivity, so it measures the largest scales very well, but its noise due to the beam, so the point spread function essentially cuts off the very smallest scales. This is a much more expensive, so-called mid-cost version of this experiment, roughly the same sensitivity, but a much finer point spread function that allows it to go much smaller scales.
You have to run into B modes that are caused by a lens.
That's right. I will talk about
it.
Yes, so the whole point of going to very large scales is that you don't have to worry about that so much at these levels. So the signal will basically come from this part, which I'm going to call the reionization bump, and this part, which is the recombination bump. And in later figures, I'll show how the lensing contribution goes, but it basically does that. So if you want to use something out here where not much signal comes from anyway, you don't have to subtract the lensing contribution. At the very largest scales, the foregrounds will be the dominant systematic. So these foregrounds are foregrounds from the fact that the magnetic field of our galaxy causes electrons to mimic primordial B-modes. So at certain frequencies, that's dominated by synchrotron, which is just electrons firing around in the galactic field. Free is not really expected to polarize, so I won't really discuss that. There's also dust that absorbs and emits CMB light, and that can be polarized as well because the large-scale magnetic fields of the galaxy are homogeneous. You can see some of this structure here. This is a supernova remnant. This is the plane of our galaxy. So clearly you can't use this part for cosmological work, but actually you know, everywhere, even outside the galactic plane, the foregrounds are expected to dominate the tensor primordial signature unless you look in very specific, very, very small little holes. So right now, these foregrounds are actually uncertain by about an order of magnitude in amplitude. So this is L equals 4, which is roughly at what I call the realization bump here. And so it's a function of frequency. Synchrotron falls as a function of frequency, and dust rises. And this is our current uncertainty, or characterization of it, as a function of frequency in these two dominant foreground contaminants. This is our 0.1, and this is 0.001. This is just one scale, yeah? And then this is L of 80, which is the what I call the recombination bump. This thing here. And again, these things are going down, these things are rising. So WMAP has basically measured up to 90 gigahertz. And we're going to need Planck to nail down what the dust is doing. With the dust, with the synchrotron, we at least have some idea about how it behaves as a function of scale and frequency at the very largest scales, but with the dust, we do not. So we need much more information at higher frequencies. So the main thing to take away from this is that foregrounds are functions of scale and of frequency, and they're not simple functions of scale necessarily, so you have to have a lot of information as a function of frequency and scale in order to subtract them. So this is this particular frequency, 90 gigahertz, where we expect that there's a rough minimum between this thing dropping and this thing rising. So this is the Lenzing contribution at R of 0.001 with standard cosmological parameters. And you can see that this is going to be a problem to use these very high scales. This is a current understanding of synchrotron at this scale, and that comes from WMAP. We don't really understand the behavior of the dust, so this is a parameterization of our uncertainty in that as a function scale at this particular frequency. So this upper limit is a lower limit, and this is an actual simulation. And that's what you have to deal with to get down here. So these are current constraints on primordial parameters. So this is the spectral index versus tensor scale ratio. And for theorists, what you're really trying to understand are these two kind of very broad features of data. First of all, is it red or blue? Is it large field and delta phi greater than N Planck or small field? That will tell you whether the theory has a shift symmetry or not in the form of potential. And the combination of these two observables gives you the curvature of the potential. So you're putting in all this work, you're trying to get this very large scale, you know, broad features of the underlying theory. So that these are the current constraints in that plane. So in this work, we basically tried to forecast what these CMB Paul experiments can do, taking into account the foreground uncertainty. It's a heroic effort that has to be done in order to do this. Multi-frequency measurements at a whole range of scales. So the low-cost mission can basically do that. If the underlying universe had 0.01 in tensor scale ratio, and the 2-meter mission can kind of do that. So this is mid-cost and this is low-cost. So on that previous diagram, these are the current constraints. This is what Planck is expected to do. Planck is expected to narrow down the constraints on the spectral index of the scalar power spectrum very, very well. But it really won't tell you anything about R of 0.01. And that's what these CMB formations can do. So if this thing gets built, and this is indeed detected, this is how it translates into energy scales that we are probing. So this is our 0.1 and 0.001 here. But in turn, because this scales as the energy scale scales as part of the quarter, it's basically probing the guts. So just to conclude, what have we learned so far? So we're basically still testing basic aspects of the implementation mechanism rather than its specific implementation. And this reconstruction tool is very useful for testing the inflationary paradigm. But specific models have already been tested. For example, if they have large tensors like lambda 5 to the fourth or blue tilt like many hybrid models. And many popular models are on the verge of being tested seriously. I didn't get a chance to talk about this. And in terms of future observational prospects, you can do three things, at least, to understand the physics of the universe. Let's go to small scales. So you can get much better measurements of the primordial scalar power spectrum shape. So Planck will go to LF3000. We are right now at about LF800 in the CMB in terms of high signal noise. Acton CMB, the South Pole telescope actually can go to much higher L, but then you have to model secondary effects. Galaxies can go to about 1 inverse megaparsec, then you have to deal with non-linearity and bias, probe structure formation. Lamin alpha can get you to about 5 inverse megaparsecs. They have to model gas physics and radiation feedback. And then deionization epoch, these 21 centimeter experiments, can go to another about order of magnitude in scale, but pretty much everything is unknown. So that's a new frontier that's coming up. You can try to detect gravitational waves, either indirectly with the CMB, for example, with the CMB Poltec mission, and that's at very large scales. Or you can try to do it directly by detection of primordial gravitational waves at solar system scales. So there's a very futuristic experiment called the Big Bang Observer, which is going to maybe in the future do that. Another avenue, which I didn't really get a chance to talk about that much, is to detect this primordial non-Gaussianity. So slow roll inflation predicts roughly this epsilon parameter of order 1. That's probably going to be very hard to detect. Oh, but if it's much greater than 1, like a lot of these explicit models seem to say, then Planck should certainly have something to say about that, and also a lot of information about large-scale structure. And beyond that, you can ask, can we distinguish the shape dependence? It's almost certainly true. Or scale dependence, which is much harder, and you have to combine it in many differences. Finally, I just want to advertise the 2009 summer program, this workshop called Fingerprints of the Early Universe. And I invite you all to come. And the applications for this are due on the Aspen website by the 31st of January. And we are hoping that theorists will come and phenomenologists will come and also experiment with this. So it could be quite exciting. Thank you very much.
Questions? We're going to take your Rania to dinner this evening at 6:30. What's that for everybody? First question from John.
There are several non-inflationary models of the Earth, for example, Planck's model.
Mm-hmm.
And evidently, if you assume the pressure state from contracting phase to the space, you get scaling waves.
Mm-hmm.
And you obviously solve the Riesel problem because the Paris inverse of H is infinite.
Mm-hmm.
So, if we throw this into the scheme of things, how do we distinguish between inflation and non-inflation model? There is some inflation. There's a 1E flow to get Paris.
Okay, so there are certain things you can do with gravitational waves. As far as I know, there's a robust prediction from these models that it has some blue tilt.
Some have, some models have already had the gravitational wave computed.
Right.
So they could be within the region where you're
Oh, they're large, are they?
0.01.
Really? Yeah. Ah, so that's cool. Do they also predict a non-Gaussian signature?
It's this model. There is no gravitational drive.
That's what I thought. I wasn't aware of this other one.
What is the other model?
Well, there's a, I have a model, and there's a Brandenburg who came here from the tree.
Yeah.
I have a model. Other people have models.
But even that one, even if it's 0.01, it has a blue tilt, doesn't it? The Brandenburg, the one that I'm aware of.
Yeah.
In inflation, you don't get the blue tilt. Yeah. So that's one way of discriminating between them. It's very, very hard, actually, observationally, to verify the consistency condition that relates to the spectral index of the tensors with its amplitude. One thing you could do is to combine data from very different defaults like that. And I mean, if you have a blue spectral index and at the CMB scales it's 0.01, probably you'll see something in LISA. The reason it's so hard with inflation is that it goes the other way. So that's one possible option. Another thing that at least I'm aware of Justin's models is that they make a prediction for large local non-Gaussianity. And that's also quite hard to get from inflation, and it has a positive sign.
Gaggio has biometric gravity models.
Yes.
Published recently. So there's another.
Yeah. So in terms of all this, you know, very hard observations and only a limited set of them. So you really have to come up with multiple tests you can do between. That's kind of the ultimate answer.
Other question?
Justin? Yeah. So coming back to what I was asking about, this formalism of your flow parameters. So for example, I'm curious. So for example, if I have this a pure exponential potential, This I know gives me exactly constant equation of state, which I would think of as a pretty simple model. Mm-hmm. But in this flow parameterization, you need an infinite number of flow parameters to parameterize an exponential derivation. I'm just trying to think, like, in other words, is it clear that the sort of things I might think of as simple in terms of an equation of state necessarily matches on to a few small, few parameters in your flow?
I have to think about the exponential model. But what usually fails in this kind of context is if there's a rapid variation of some parameter that's only transient, that it's in a very, very small range. And in that case, you can usually tell something's wrong, because there'll be a discrepancy between just fitting a standard empirical parameterization and doing the reconstruction. And in that case, you know, you shouldn't probably trust the reconstruction, and hence, you know, you should look carefully about the data is collecting.
So people have done this exercise of just taking like the 100 simplest, the top 100 simplest models, let's say, and seeing if they correspond to simple.
I really wish I had a chance to go through that missing part of my talk, because it was precisely about, can we say something simple just from the virtue of the shape of the potential. And I don't think you can. I don't think that's a good tool for characterizing naturalness of inflation. At the end of the day, you really have to come back to some top-down physics.
Right.
So I think using just one of these techniques is never going to give you the full answer. You have to try all of them and just kind of, you know, there's no one thing you can say, this is the diagnostic. I can go through that stuff place. I'm here all week, by the way. I'm in office 258, and I'd love to talk to anybody.
Great to mention that. Great. So, other questions? Levan?
So, some people try to reconstruct the probability of potential, what they said, directly from by fitting things like wavelets.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that's not included in one of the three ways you described. What do you think about that? Is it promising?
I certainly think it's not a useless exercise, but this is being recorded.
Yes.
You said it's not useless.
That's much more likely to pick up systematics in data. And also there's the problem, at least the current ways that it has been implemented, that you have no control of errors on the reconstructed aspect. There are ways to attach errors to that kind of thing. For example, I worked on a thing called cross-validation, which is a way to fit more and more arbitrary functions to the data, more and more complex functions. But cross-validation is a way to statistically tell whether an additional parameter is just fitting the noise or whether it's actually extracting information. So you can do that kind of thing to see whether these systematics, these features from the shape, the wavelets are coming from systematics or from actual underlying or noise realization or something like that. So there are certainly ways to improve them, but as currently done, I think it's very problematic to infer physics from them.
But there is hope.
There is hope.
So I feel that, yes, if you decorrelate, try to decorrelate noise and
that's a hard
thing. Features, and maybe you could see something you cannot see with.
Yes. With features, I should mention this mission that's going to go after the TensorMod has very good use in terms of trying to see whether features are there or not. So, because if there's a feature in the temperature, that you can usually make a prediction for the polarization that could induce. And actually, the polarization transfer function is narrower than the temperature one, as you know. So, features are better preserved in polarization.
Yeah,
and so you can do consistency.
That's a good point.
Any more questions? If not, okay.
A very brief clarification. When you assume a different breathing temperatures, are you also changing the scale inflation?
Yes. Yeah. So what we do is to say, okay, let's take the observational scales, assuming phi equals zero, and then you have an exact solution, right? You can extrapolate that scale with inflation. You see if inflation happens or not. And you say that inflation has to happen for x e folds, and that x is set by what the reading scale is.
Yes, but you could also fill the gap with the matter.
So it's done exactly with that connection equation I showed. So that's precisely what we're doing. We set the parameters here, we extrapolate, we calculate that NFK, we set the prime. And prime goes.
Okay, great, thank you.